Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This weather, like we're having today, it tends to put me in a contemplative mood and I feel like asking those moody questions like, what does it all mean and why and what can we do? Well, it's the right headspace for this next conversation with Edward O. Wilson. He's professor emeritus at Harvard and one of the living giants in the natural sciences. His resume of accomplishments, quite frankly, is too long to recite here, but one of the most delightful things about him, E.O. Wilson doesn't mind if you just called him the ant guy. Of course, he is so much more than that. Wilson, though, has turned his attention lately from the littlest creatures on Earth to the most powerful species ever to walk the planet. That's us. The 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner has just concluded a trilogy of books contemplating the role of humankind in nature and how our power and super-evolved brains are bringing about the destruction of the natural world. So in his final book in the trilogy, Wilson presents a solution. It's called Half-Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. And E.O. Wilson suggests quite plainly that to save nature, we must set aside half the Earth's land and water for conservation. And when I talked with him, I began by asking Wilson, really? Did he really think that's possible?
Yes, I do. And it can be done. The rate of extinction is now it's climbing, and it's upwards toward 1,000 times the rate of extinction before humans came along.
And would setting aside half the Earth's surface
stop
that?
There's only one solution available, and that's to set aside half of the Earth. And the reason why I say one half is that how much area must you put aside to save, shall we say, 80%
right,
or 85 in that vicinity? And that area would be one half. Now comes the question, well, how are you going to, for heaven's sake, take up half of the area of the sea and half of Earth in order to save a large majority of the species still existing?
Well, I mean, you point out that last year some 15% of the Earth's land area was already set aside.
3% of the sea, 15% of the Earth. And the answer to that is, we're not going to take anybody out. Those who live within that area are not expected to give up private property or have any of their rights abrogated.
Uh-huh. Well, can I jump in here for a second, Professor? Because I think you made exactly the point that I was going to ask you about. Because my pushback wasn't so much how do you get the people out, but that perhaps it's easy for a Harvard professor to say we should set aside half the Earth when the people who may rely on that half of the Earth would say we need it for other things, you know, for agriculture, for our livelihoods, for the growing population, et cetera. But I think I'm hearing the beginnings of your answer to that pushback.
At this point, it is hoped, and I think it can work already to some extent, that by moral reasoning, by pride of people in the land they occupy, and by what I hope will be a shift toward a new moral imperative. And then we see in every aspect of evolving markets the tendency in competitive market system to produce better with less energy, less material. There are so many things that high technology promises us that is going to reduce what is called the ecological footprint.
So technology could facilitate the setting aside of half the Earth. I'm not quite so convinced about political will being adequate right now.
Certainly. The knuckle draggers at the top need education. But I find dealing particularly with younger people and more educated people, I've gotten nothing but enthusiasm over this as a movement to take.
Well, in the book, Half Earth, there's one particular chapter where you write about some of the best places in the biosphere. And, of course, there's the Amazon. I love how you point out the longleaf pine savanna of the American South, the part of the country you know very well. The Pantanal in South America, the Cerrado, the Christian Orthodox Church forests in Ethiopia. You point out many places in Asia, and even the McMurdo Dry Valleys in Antarctica.
When you start patching all those together, where there are very few people anyway in many cases, you're going to be climbing pretty quickly to 50%.
You know, Professor Wilson, if I may, what I really want to talk with you about today is your view of humankind and our place in this great system of nature that we find ourselves on this planet. Because in listening to you, I can hear a great degree of optimism in terms of the plan that we can set ourselves as a goal for saving the biodiversity of Earth. But in reading the book, I honestly can't quite tell if you share that same optimism about humankind itself. Sometimes you take a pretty dim view of us as a species.
The key to, shall we say, attenuating the kinds of irrational pressures we've been putting on the world and on each other, including runaway armaments and constant tribal conflict, also sometimes called competition among religions. The key is self-understanding. And this is why I'm very much concerned with the relatively poor standing and prestige and achievement of the humanities. I think that the time has come that we have sufficient understanding of both the humanities as depicted and understood by its best scholars and the leading scientists in the key areas of anthropology, evolutionary biology, brain science, a way of making the effort to unify now and to plunge deeper by asking the big questions once again. Questions like, what is life? Why must we die? What determines our longevity? What is an ideal social system?
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about certain things that you point out about human beings. In the book Half Earth, you ask, do we consider ourselves demigods? We are the most powerful species on the planet right now. We have these brains that are capable of perhaps seeing into the future or creating technologies or fashioning an Earth that our bodies actually couldn't survive. We're uniquely suited for the time we were evolved into, but perhaps not the time that we are creating for the planet. All of these things. And I think, you know, many of your admirers who nevertheless may disagree with you would say, Professor Wilson, all of these things are absolutely true, but this is also another way of saying the time of nature has passed and that humankind is dominant, and that's simply a reality that we have to accept.
To be dominant is not an imperative to destroy, particularly if it's going to come back at us big time in increasing amounts to our future generations. I like to characterize the human condition today as we have Paleolithic emotions. Mm-hmm. We have medieval institutions, in which I would include churches and, how shall I put it, poorly run banks, and a rather, shall we say, clumsy political system. And we have godlike powers. So that's a very dangerous combination. We need to use our powers and our sense of responsibility as a species, if I can use that expression, to find stabilization of the planet in a way that will ensure our security and also the sustaining of the rest of life.
Yeah.
Because we have no idea how much we depend on the rest of life. We are just beginning primitively to start the study, the real analysis of ecosystems. We don't even know an estimated 80% of the species of animals, plants, and organisms on the earth, not even know them with a scientific name. How can we really understand what the rest of life means to us and how we can manage this planet in a way that saves the rest of the life just from pure prudence alone?
Well, what does the rest of life mean to you?
Well, it's worth a lifetime of my puny existence.
I mean, yes, every waking day or every day of effort and science that you've contributed is, I think, evidence enough of what all of life means to you. But I ask you that question because of what you just said, that we as collectively as a species don't recognize what the rest of life means to us. So I thought, you know, maybe I might ask you to articulate what it means.
Well, life is 3.5 billion years old on this planet. It's had all that time to create a physical environment in the atmosphere and in the waters that humanity evolved in fine detail to survive and reproduce in. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense to start meddling or continue meddling with that enormous biosphere without knowing what we're doing.
Yeah.
So at the very least, even if you don't care about all the rest of life, prudence dictates go carefully.
Can we take a little bit of a tangent here? Because you had mentioned a minute or two ago that we do not even know the vast majority of the species that are currently sharing the planet with us. Was it some 80% of the species we haven't, science has not yet identified? That's the estimation?
Yes, it's we know almost exactly right now. It just happens to be 2 million species, given, identified, diagnosed a bit, given a scientific name.
Well, what I wanted to ask you was, I had forgotten, but you point out in the book, Half Earth, that you yourself have identified over your career more than 400 species of ants. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
What was it like for you every time you did discover a species that had been previously unknown to science? Because it's, you know, it's one more piece of that puzzle,
yeah,
that we're filling in.
I get what I like to call an aesthetic jolt. You know, this is different. This is new. This is beautiful. And I get that little jolt.
Yeah.
And that keeps me going. I could have found thousands.
Yeah, including one that I think is called P. Harrison Forde. Is that right?
Well, it's Phaidoli. Yes, that was, the genus is Phaidoli.
Yeah.
And as I was describing all those known 640 species up to that point, I had to describe these many new species of that genus. And, you know, there are just so many reasonable Latin and Greek-derived names. That's what you need to do. You have to at least put a suffix on the name,
right,
of a person, if you name it after a person. So having run out of those, I started naming my species, new species, after the people who had collected them. And after that, I started naming distinguished biologists and so on. And finally, I went to the president of Conservation International, where I was on the board, and I said, could you give me the name of, say, about 10 of the board members distinguished by long service and hard work and achievement in the Conservation International effort? And he gave me a number of them, and I named the species after them, and one of them is just Harrison Ford. He's a dedicated conservationist, and so I said, of course, I have to include Harrison Ford. I like the guy a lot, too. Phaidoli Harrison Fordi.
I loved it. Indiana Jones has an ant named after him, or after Harrison Ford, thanks to E.O. Wilson.
He, the night that we announced this and they gave them my drawings, you know, of each species,
yeah,
I did,
yeah,
up to 10 or more drawings on my own hand of the different species. When he found out there was one was named after him, he went out of his way with a, in a storm, no less, closed down the set and came with his wife up to that meeting to receive his aunt.
Well, that was a lovely little tangent, but I'm going to bring us back to some of the things that you talk about in depth in Half Earth. And in fact, you actually have kind of mentioned it already several times, and you've written other books about it, because your view on religion isn't the most positive one, or the religion and its effects on how human beings treat the earth. But I noticed in the book several times you actually quote directly from the Bible.
Oh, I do.
I mean, and for example, you quote one of Paul's letters in Corinthians about being in awe of God's work that we can't see.
Well, in addition to having been raised a Southern Baptist evangelical, I've strayed a bit. Of course, like everyone, I know a great piece of literature when I see it. Plus, there is a rule that I think most listeners would agree with, that with antiquity, great literature gains a patina of authenticity. And the poetry of the Bible offers many expressions of real truths that have the power not only of being true, but of having that antiquity.
I wonder, Professor Wilson, is it inevitable for a person like you, for a biologist, for a naturalist, who's dedicated their lives to understanding the mysteries of this planet of ours, is it inevitable to reach the point where that you are at? Because it feels like while you haven't let go of your optimism, there is a form of existential alarm here. And I think that there are a lot of scientists I know who feel that same profound sense of alarm.
Yes, of course. If you want to put it that way, it's one of the undercurrents of my emotional life is alarm and despair, particularly from our leadership. We just don't have leaders worldwide who have that much interest in the environment, and even less interest do they show in the living environment. Right now, we're in a odd situation in which the world is turning green, but all of the emphasis is on climate change. Of course, when you come to a life and death matter, your emphasis has to be there, and that's true. We also are concerned about pollution, and we're concerned about the loss of arable soil. Well, those are all physical aspects of the environment, and we have just forgotten about the living environment. We're not putting any concern to speak of, relatively speaking, into the living part of the environment. Mm-hmm. And believe me, if you just want to be completely anthropocentric and say all that matters is humans and the heck with the rest of life, then you are going to quickly start seeing signs of something just as dire as climate change contra human welfare.
Contra human welfare. Mm-hmm. So as I was reading your book, and I've felt this way many times reading your other books as well, of course I kept thinking of my own kids, right? Because that's one of the reasons why this matters, not just my children, but all children and our children's children, right? The future of humanity itself. And it's funny because my daughter, she's 5 and a half, she oftentimes asks me in the way that kids do, so what are we made of? And I have to be honest, I sometimes lean on Carl Sagan for an answer, and I tell her that we once were stardust now, and stardust we will become again. It seems to satisfy her. But I was thinking about that today because, ironically, that comes to my mind because, to me, we're all part of this system, this universal system of nature. And to that extent, Professor Wilson, I mean, you open the book by saying, by pointing out previous mass extinctions that have occurred even before human beings, before Homo sapien was on the planet. So, I mean, I'm struggling here, but I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, if we are a part of life, and we are, I mean, no matter what humanity does, is it not just the way evolution continues to express itself through us, that we might be triggering another mass extinction through human activity? Absolutely. But is that not also potentially part of life?
You know, when it comes to evolution, especially now that humans are one of the major evolutionary factors in the world, I don't believe in accident. We, our species, was an accident of evolution. One, you know, every species is the way an accident. But now we are evolution made conscious. And we are the minds of the world, and we must now assume responsibility as stewards of the world. We're not accidents. I mean, our future behavior, and therefore the future of all the rest of the world, especially the living world, is our domain. We are responsible. Responsible to whom? To those younger generations you're talking about. Good Lord, can you imagine what it would be like if we destroyed more than half of the species on Earth and then left for the legacy of one or two generations at our present time and our moment in our mental state of recklessness, what they would think of us, of all we destroyed, of all that potential, of all that millions of years of slow, grinding evolution that produced something so big and beautiful. I don't think they would think very highly of us, and maybe just responsibility, as I think you were indicating, to our children and to future generations is enough incentive for us to take responsibility.
Well, Edward O. Wilson is a multiple Pulitzer Prize winner and professor emeritus at Harvard. His new book is Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. Professor Wilson, it is always such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.